Now, you will have noticed we have a slightly different panel.
Yes.
Commissioner Lipson.
Hello.
And Commissioner McLeod.
Hello.
Being died by one of my witnesses, Mr. Vivian, is unfortunately got man flu.
As Harry described it.
Harry, that's his words. Yep. So.
Too much fighting.
Yeah, exactly. Healthy living. So.
We can take this as read.
Well, yeah, take this as read. Then I thought either he can come back if he recovers sufficiently, he might be able to slot it in the next couple of days.
We finish tomorrow and we've got a very full.
Right, okay. Or if you had questions for him, we could get them back to you in writing super quick.
Yes, we could look at
And even if you don't have the time to write down the questions, we could just have a conversation about them. And my colleague Ms. Hill will take them down and get them to him.
That can be more efficient than me sitting down a lot of time and drafting.
Yeah, and then you can have your lunch. Yeah.
Which I have done before, but I prefer
that.
Yeah.
So, should we do it like that?
Okay,
great.
Super. Now, you've handed up a synopsis of submissions. Is that different from the one that you handed sent in earlier?
No, it's not different. It's exactly the same. Oh. Yep.
Okay.
So, I'll take you through those reasonable details, because if I'm going to get them for a day, you might not have read them properly.
I think you just take us through them.
Yep, great. So I'll just start at section 3 under procedural matters. This is really for the benefit of the two new commissioners, just to give them a bit of background to the journey we've been on so far through the different hearing streams. And we've had reasonable involvement to date. We presented in March on hearing stream 1B on strategic direction in urban development and landscapes, just legal submissions, and then evidence from Mr. Carey in February in 1B on against strategic direction urban development and landscapes. In May, we had myself and Mr. Vivian and Mr. Gary Gray on my right, so Mr. Vivian on planning and Mr. Gray on mining and the rural chapter. And in addition to the above, we also supported the presentation of Mr. Knapp on behalf of Strattera in respect of the first hearing stream as well. So all of those presentations really set the scene for the presentation today. It's sort of a continuation of that story. So I guess I urge you to, so that you fully understand where we're coming from, to be familiar with those previous presentations, and then you'll have the full picture. And also that will put in context Mr. Vivian's recommendations for actual changes, because they all flow from the previous presentations.
Just on your paragraph 3.5,
yes.
And you suggest that provisions in streams 2, which is the rural zone provisions you're referring to, provide higher order framework.
Mm-hmm.
Is that strictly correct?
No, I suppose that they're probably without thinking about it too carefully, and we'll get Mr. Vivian to give you his opinion on that question as well. They're probably more in parallel, aren't they? The rural chapter and the heritage chapter. One doesn't drive the other.
Mm.
Yeah.
They both work together.
Yeah. But also, well, I won't speak for Mr. Vivian, because I don't know his opinion on that.
Mr. Vivian to comment on that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So an overview of the case. New Zealand Tungsten seeks to achieve a balance that gives effect to the purpose of the Act by providing for important natural heritage and landscape values identified in Section 6 and 7 of the RMA, whilst not sterilising the known mineral resource, and considers it important that future proposed mining operations should be able to be assessed on their merits on a case-by-case basis. Mining has a unique history, is recognised by the carve-out of minerals in Section 5 from the requirement to sustain the potential of resources for future generations. Minerals are finite and are not subject to that aspect of sustainable management. Mining within the Queenstown Lakes District, and particularly Glen Orchy, provides important layers to the district's cultural and landscape values and characteristics which are enjoyed to the present day. And the operative and proposed regional policy statements for Otago recognise the importance of mining to the region, and these are relevant for informing the proposed district plan. Now, just note on that point, Mr. Vivian did go into reasonable detail on the relevant provisions from those proposed and operative RPs, so if you did have questions about that, he particularly addressed it in this hearing stream. Mining differs from other land uses that occur in the rural zone because suitable locations for mining are wholly dictated by the location of the mineral resource, and there is no ability to consider alternative sites where the activity could occur and then consider a range of factors to weigh up the most appropriate site, as new sites cannot be found if the minerals are not there or are not economically recoverable. The consequence is that if mining is unacceptable in a particular location because of other considerations, then that represents an opportunity foregone and that opportunity cannot be realised elsewhere. Adverse effects of mining are temporary, and modern mining methods and rehabilitation techniques continue to advance and improve. And on the topic of heritage, on either side of me are experts about that, the rehabilitation and the potential sort of restorative benefits that mining can provide, as well as providing a continuation of a story that is reflected in the landscape. So hopefully you'll be able to that you've got particular expertise on this, Commissioner Nugent, so we're looking forward to some good questions.
Yes, I think Ms. Hill was here yesterday when I mentioned my degree as an archaeologist, but she wasn't here when I also mentioned that my essay, my research essay for my planning degree was actually on heritage landscapes.
Oh, right. There you go.
And Justice Moore was doing his archaeology degree at Otago at the same time that I was.
Oh.
You might also find interesting.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Well, there you go. Explains why he issued
such
a comprehensive decision. Goodness. Outstanding natural landscapes and features, or ONFLs, must be adequately identified for the qualities which they exhibit, in order to then provide fit-for-purpose protection. And an unqualified blanket protection of ONFLs is not required, nor is it appropriate under Part 2 of the Act. Providing for modern-day mining within an existing heritage mining landscape will provide a contemporary connection to that place, which has social and cultural benefits for the community. This hearing provides more detailed planning provisions for New Zealand Tungsten's current and future operations undertaken within the Glenorchy heritage landscape. So our entire relief for this chapter is focused on the Glenorchy heritage landscape. The relief sought within this hearing is to appropriately protect the landscape while allowing for continued maintenance and enhancement through modern-day mining. The final involvement of this submitted in the proposed plan will be in the rezoning hearings to be heard early 2017, sometime in 2017. New Zealand Tungsten seeks that the ONF line at the base of Mount Alfred be amended to match the true classification and topography of the landscape. The earliest submissions considering the law related to identification and protection of ONFLs and continue to consider that there is a procedural and legal issue with forming the text of the landscape chapter prior to determination of the extent to which the landscapes.
I continue to disagree with you on
yes.
that.
Yes, yeah.
Record that.
Okay. So that was really just to give you the full picture of the submission so that we're all on the same page in sort of a summary form. Structure in the plan for mining and activity status. It provides for mining activities through the following chapters, 3, 21 and 26. And the rural zone provides the bulk of the standards that are directly relevant for mining. And I've set out the key provisions recognising the existence of mining sit under the objective 21.2.5. And new policies have been added into the chapter through Council's, well, have been recommended, I should say, through Council's right to reply to hearing stream 02.
I was going to ask that question.
Yes, sorry about that. Which provide for compensation and reduce the sensitivity aspects of mining. Mining activities then range from permitted for limited forms of prospecting and minor extraction to control for exploration up to 20 cubes up to discretionary for larger scale mining. And a discretionary application for mining will be assessed for appropriateness against the higher order strategic direction provisions in and probably the landscape chapters of Fremont. Assessment matters for ONM valves are also contained within the rural chapter and include considerations of vegetation disturbance, effects on landscape quality and character, visual amenity and cumulative effects. And policies and objectives are also contained within the landscape chapter to guide the above determination. Landscape assessment matter 21713C also requires consideration of cultural attributes, including historical and heritage associations. And just to be clear, we're not challenging the rigour or the activity status for the majority of those rules. And there was one change we sought maybe to the exploration activities, but nothing material. So we're not seeking to sort of weaken the consenting requirements at all. The main relief sought in those previous rounds was to increase the recognition of the importance of mining, I guess, without sort of saying, and you know, you don't need to go through any rigorous consenting process to do it. Because you do. The definition of earthworks excludes mining activities as defined in as amended through Plan Change 49.
That's only in the operative plan though, isn't it? That's not in the proposed plan.
Yes, I think Mr. Vivian goes into that in some detail, doesn't he? The definition.
Yes, and I don't think here. Several people have fallen into this
plan
because of the council having this rush of plan changes, been bringing out the proposed district plan, and all those plan changes only relate to the operative plan.
Yes,
no effect on this plan. Presumably, at some stage, they will be brought in, but at that point, of course, people can make submissions on them and seek
that's
to change
right.
them.
Yeah.
So.
That's right, we can't assume
yes.
that PC 49 will just stay in place. I know it is very awkward, isn't it? Because there will be PC 50 that's staying
in
place.
We had discussions with Mr. Farrell about that just before.
Oh, did you? Right, of course, yeah, for the cottage.
Yes.
And PC 44, so it does seem like there's a lot of, you know, a lot of plan changes in the operative plan that are going to have a long life. But I have to admit.
And there's even a more confusing one over in Wanaka, which is notified privately.
The recent one.
And they want the same thing in both plans, but they're not hearing what being heard by the same commissioners at the same time.
Oh, goodness. So perhaps if we look at what Mr. Vivian has said in his evidence, and if there's anything more what's been enlightening about this conversation, he can clarify. We'll be able to clarify his interpretation of that.
Is the issue that until the specific earthwork provisions are brought into the proposed plan, we can't assume that mining is excluded from them, and then that should be a compensatory thing when they are brought in? I'm just thinking of our it's one of the difficulties the council has created by only doing the plan in part.
So this is a question because I don't know the answer to it. Is there no definition of earthworks in the proposed plan?
Well, there may be, because they seem to have included definitions follows from the operative plan. Yes, there is.
Yeah.
And it doesn't exclude mining.
And it doesn't exclude mining, oh,
because
okay.
it predates Plan Change 49 from page 2-8.
Yes, all right. We'll have a look at, because I know that Mr. Vivian does address this in some detail. Mm.
Now, that may be that your client's submission actually relates to that definition, and we are dealing with the definitions later, but not packed up on the way through. So, in the very last set of hearings, actually.
Yeah.
So that might be worth while checking that. So
yes, it is all ringing bells. I'm pretty sure we did address it in the submission. So we'll send it out eventually. 5.8, associated services to mining, in my submission, may also require consideration of broader rules and plans, such as temporary buildings and effects of activities on the surface of lakes and rivers. And in addition to the above, New Zealand Tungsten's operations are focused on where historic mining sites were established over Shiite reefs at Glenorchy. The Glenorchy Heritage Landscape provides a further layer of protection of historic heritage through the PDP for assessing proposed mining activities. The point of the above list is to show that although mining is a discretionary activity in the PDP, it also has many stringent layers and levels of protection it has to be assessed against before it can proceed. And that list does not cover the additional requirements relevant under separate legislation to the RMA when applying for the natural HSA access arrangements, which is where, rather than mining permits, it's the access arrangement process to access Crown land to exercise your mining permit that imposes another level of similar but different environmental protections.
That's an ownership issue.
Yes, though it's only triggered when it's Crown land that the need for an application that gets granted by DOC or LINS generally.
But any other owner could do the same thing,
couldn't they? And will. But they don't need to have regard to the environmental effects, do they, other owners? Whereas DOC has to apply to
DOC.
Sure.
Yes, I understand the DOC concession issue, but what I was getting at is that if any landowner wanted to, they would require something of a similar standard to before they would consider granting access. They're in that position, aren't they?
I think 100% of the time, basically, with that. My experience, 100%.
Okay. It's also noteworthy that there is potential overlap or duplication in some provisions, such as the assessment of heritage effects under the GHL, as well as cultural heritage attributes of the landscape assessment methods. The provisions of the GHL, my submission, should therefore be as focused and as simple as possible in order to avoid potential inconsistencies.
Do you really get duplication? Well, if you think about it, if you have two assessment methods that make you look at the same thing, do you assess it twice?
Well, as long as they're entirely consistent, that's the risk, is that when there's a different slant or different weighting or, you know, just different words, then you have to address them both, but differently. It's sort of an unnecessary duplication. It's not a big point that we're making, but
is around the heritage legislation. If it's pre-1900, it's picked up by the Heritage New Zealand Act, but you may still require a similar heritage impact assessment for a resource consent for post-1900 sites, if you understand what I mean.
Mm.
So there would be, you'd be requiring two, essentially, applications, one for an archaeological authority and one for a resource consent.
Yes, the issue, I think Ms. Hill was here when I asked Ms. Scott about this, whether there was an ability for the council to offer a provision that when an archaeological approval was sought under the Heritage New Zealand Act, that somehow the rules provided for that to be capable of being considered under the plan. So we understand that, and because we've had the same situation arising in respect of Indigenous vegetation with ski fields. Yes. And I think the council in its reply from memory did suggest some wording to obviate that need for two applications of the same sort. So I think in that sense, that duplication is avoided. When it does not require Heritage New Zealand approval, meaning it's post-1900, it still nonetheless would be an archaeological site in terms of the district plan, as I understand it. That's how I read the provision.
Yeah, yes, that is one type of duplication, and if council followed through on that, would remove that particular duplication. But I was more actually talking about between the chapter 21 and chapter 26. There is, you know, because there's the landscape chapter and the heritage landscape provisions, there is an element of overlap and duplication there that, you know, we just have to be very careful about to make sure it's necessary and not unnecessary and is entirely consistent so as to avoid any sort of confusion down the track.
I haven't thought that any major proposal for a consent invariably involves a number of different parts of the district plan and is also likely to involve parts of the regional plan. A comprehensive assessment of effects is usually done once and then it deals with all of those issues in one hit. I'm not convinced that having things in two different chapters creates anything more problematic that would otherwise be faced.
It's not that there are two different chapters, it's just that there are two different chapters assessing the same aspect of the environment through a different lens. That's all. Yeah. But like I say, it's not a biggie. The next section is just a small, primarily about Justice Moore's decision about heritage landscapes. And I mean, I don't want to belabour this if it's something the panel's reasonably familiar with, because I think you'll get more out of questioning my witnesses than you will out of me trawling through this, but I'm sort of in your hands if you want to.
I do have some questions about the parts of the decision that have been quoted.
Okay, yep. well, should we just go to your questions, perhaps?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, just cutting to paragraph 6.5, where you refer to paragraph 47, I think it is. I just wondered whether, in fact, and later on you've also referred to another paragraph, 90-something. I just wondered whether it is in actual fact paragraph 100 in his decision, which really sets out Justice Moore's consideration of how you deal with matters when it's both section 6, potentially 6B. In that case, it was 6, whatever it is, F and 7.
Paragraph 100.
Yes. Where he says it's artificial to attempt to segregate or quarantine the various Part 2 matters, and that they are values which are shared and their consideration must inevitably to some extent overlap when examining the value of importance subscribed to them.
Yes.
That, I think, is really the nub of his decision.
Yeah.
In his earlier parts, he is talking about what other judges have said,
yeah.
More than coming to his own conclusions. That was the feeling that I got.
Yes, that's right. He does have some that journey.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, well, for the words about it, I agree that paragraph 100 is a good summing up on this. Is if you are considering how to consider heritage landscapes, that point about attempt to segregate those considerations can be artificial.
Mm.
It's
certainly
relevant to the Glenorchy
landscape. Yes, sir, it is also listed as being a natural landscape. The other, or in Mount Elbert, and other myth, if I remember.
Yep.
And the other question I had was whether we changed it to heritage area.
Yes.
Well, that would overcome that problem.
Yes.
No longer says landscape. And I noticed that that was one of the things suggested by, I think,
that was in the Wholesome case.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I've been rereading that this morning, the Western case. I thought that made perfect sense.
Yes. Yeah. And it strikes me that the case that Justice Moore was dealing with was based on the presumption that the methodology in Dr. Stevenson's report had been followed.
Mm.
And I don't think that methodology has been followed in this instance either.
Mm.
So I don't think we can say that these landscapes have been heritage areas have been defined following that idea of historic landscape.
I think I won't speak to an expert, but I think I won't speak to you. I don't know what your view is specifically on that, but potentially.
Okay.
It's not evidence in the council materials in any event whether that methodology has been followed.
Right. Now you haven't directly you referred us to the Clinton Cares case.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to disclose that I was one of the witnesses in that case.
Oh, right.
And the reference there to Ms. Lucas's landscape evidence was peripheral to the case overall, and I don't think too much weight can be put on what arose out of her evidence.
Right.
Probably the fairest way to put it. I was planning on this for Clinton Cares, and it actually hung on the wording of the regional policy statement.
Right.
Not the landscape.
Yes, okay.
Now, in paragraph 6.10, you follow on from there to discuss recognising the importance of modern mining, etc. I just wondered, is it fair to say from that submission that NZTM accept there's a need to recognise the succession of mining periods, including the present or future?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely, yeah.
Skip right through to 7.8 if you're going that far. And this is to do with the amendments offered by Mr. Villian.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering whether if we refer to paragraph 89 of the Springfields decision. It's on page 26 of the decision. And I'm just wondering if there's the intention of NZTM that the regime that Mr. Vivian is seeking to have included is one that accords with the conclusions reached by the court in that paragraph.
The finding that it grieves sensitive urban development to properly constrain with good measure effect to the purpose of the act and a total restraint.
Yes.
Yes. See, that's the paragraph of the draw. Yeah.
Right. Obviously changing urban development to mining development.
Yeah.
I can't imagine we have some land up there for urban development.
It would make a quite a wonderful place for a selling switch.
So that was the questions I had out of the casebook.
Great, thank you. That's good. All right, well, what I'll do is I'll just, instead of reading out anything else, oh, no, I'll read out my section 9, modern day uses of heritage landscapes, including mining, on page 14. Dr. Corden and Mr. Gray both consider ways in which New Zealand tungsten could facilitate contemporary appreciation of heritage mines in the GHL to provide continued enjoyment, understanding and connection to these areas. In this respect, Dr. Court concludes that the PDP does not have a means of valuing the ongoing occupation by an industry or an original or long-term occupier who contributes to the overall historical, social and cultural significance of a space, thus does not allow for the sustaining use of historic heritage. The added new policy 26544 and amendments to objective 26521 and amendments to the description of the Whenuakea heritage landscape are all intended to achieve this concept. These amendments are partially accepted by Council's officers and partially further amended by Mr. Vivian to ensure consistency of resource management language where possible. As discussed above in Gavin Wallace, the concept of a living heritage landscape is not new to the court. The RMA does not require heritage to be preserved in the sense that it shall be maintained in an existing permanent state. Therefore, additions which seek to recognise ongoing economic uses of heritage, or the high likelihood of recommencing mining in the GHL, and the enablement of continued mining activities are all acceptable legal concepts which give effect to Section F of the Act and associated case law.
One thing that you haven't considered in your discussion of case law, all of those cases predated King Salmon.
Yes.
And the use of the word inappropriate may have a slightly different sense following King Salmon. If I was following properly the discussion that was going on between other commissioners and council, particularly in the Stream 1 hearings. And I think we will, to be fair, we'll have to ensure that any decision here is consistent with those conclusions.
Yes.
We reached in Stream 1 on that particular point.
Right. Has that conclusion been the subject of a written direction from the panel?
No.
No, right.
But internally.
Internally, you've got. Okay. Yep, you're right. We didn't address King Salmon. I might give that some extra thought.
Yes, and as I recall, the Supreme Court said that in determining inappropriateness, it's in terms of the matter to be protected under the Act. I think that they were referring to Section 6A from memory. But the term must have the same meaning in each of the parts of Section 6 that it is used. And that, so therefore including the word in the policies has no meaningful effect, because the section itself refers back into itself.
Well, the key, I think, difference, which may mean King Salmon's got limited effect here, is that it was applying much more black and white policies from the NZCPS that simply referred to avoid adverse effects without the qualifier of inappropriate.
I've got that. I had that question coming up later, but I'll ask you now.
So that that's the key distinguishing factor, I think, that we all grappled with in the earlier hearing stream.
Well, yes. But in the absence of a black and white policy and a higher order document, is there any reason in law, while the planning, the district plan cannot have such a black and white policy?
If it's justified on its merits.
That's what I was meaning.
It's justified on its merits.
And it's still giving effect to the regional policy statement, which is the only thing that we need to give effect
that's
to.
That's correct, yep. Yep.
So while it may not be forced upon the circumstances as they were in the King Salmon case.
Yes.
It still was a possible outcome.
Yes, it's a legal outcome. It's a lawful outcome.
Mm.
If you justify it on the merits and evidence.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then finally, very briefly, on an effects-based approach, another, small but important point. The evidence that Mr. Vivian discusses a potential consequential amendment to the definition of farm building to address council officers' concerns over permitting further buildings in the rural zone where mining is a generally discretionary activity. For the avoidance of doubt, it is submitted that an amendment to the definition of farm building instead of an included definition of mining building will be within the scope of the NZTN submission by way of a consequential or alternative relief sought. And this matter, it may be further addressed, it will be further addressed.
Yes, I think that's probably better left
in the future hearing. Definition.
It doesn't seem to fit into this hearing. Probably.
No, it doesn't. But it's sort of hard to know what to do or not sometimes, so we can do it really just to be safe. So I will move on though, and we'll address it in the definitions chapter. So evidence. I won't read out the summary of evidence here because my witnesses both have two-page summaries that they'll read out to remind you of their evidence. So I think first we'll have Mr. Gray to talk about mining and his experience with mining and mining heritage, and then finish with Dr. Port to talk about heritage, landscapes and mining. So Mr. Gray will just be reading to you his executive summary and his conclusion. So from this brief that you will already have. So you'll start on page 1 and then you'll skip to page 10.
Now, Mr. Gray, you described in great detail at the last hearing how mining works, which was very helpful, and I'm the only one who heard that. So if you feel the need to assist my fellow commissioners by giving further explanation, please do so.
So that's a conversation, the practicality of what would be occurring.
Yes, and how the mining would occur and that sort of thing.
Okay, so if I don't touch on it as I go through here, I'll trumpet it or something.
Okay.
I had a pretty picture with me, which might actually help. So I was free from the executive summary. So New Zealand Tungsten Mining Limited holds exploration and prospecting permits for tungsten, gold, and other minerals that together cover the majority of what is now the Aotearoa heritage landscape. My evidence previously dated to April 2016, respect to the rural chapter, is where I've provided a summary of the relevance of tungsten mining within the district, which has that been, is the panel aware of the history of the district?
I'll let Commissioner Nixon decide that he wants to ask questions.
I'm reasonably familiar with the history. I would have read through the evidence sheet, so I read about it. There's a few questions I'll ask, but I do have a great understanding.
Okay. So since the 1800s, mining activity has contributed significantly to the growth and development in the Queensland Lakes District. In particular, it's led to the establishment of the Gwinnett Heritage Landscape. Tungsten is a critical element. It's a metal that's in short supply in the Western world, and the Glenorchy Shiela deposits do have the potential to contain significant amounts of tungsten, and NZTM is actively exploring with the aim of resuming mining within the Glenorchy Heritage Landscape. The most likely future mining method will be small-scale underground mining in a manner which is similar to that which has been undertaken historically, and this is where I might just put in a little bit about that type of mining methods. It's not to say that surface mining may not happen, but it's most likely that underground mining methods will occur. And on page 6 of the evidence, there is actually a photograph which is taken underground at the old state line So it's section 8.2. That's in the Glenorchy Heritage Landscape, which last operated in 1970. It was when actually that tunnel was made, and generally involves a driving of a tunnel into the hillside. You can see illustrated here. The tunnel is approximately 2 metres high, and those tunnels are simply driven into the along these narrow reefs or veins, which is where the geolite is contained. So it's generally limited by the geology, and it's not 50 metre thick layers. It's actually generally between 10 centimetres or 1 centimetre and maybe 1 or 2 metres thick. So it naturally limits the size of the mining that can occur. And undertaking with similarly small scale equipment, whether it even be like the old times handheld drills or now perhaps more mechanised methods, but still small machines holding drills to drill and blast out the rock, which is then drawn out from the mine and taken for processing to occur on the surface of the land. That makes sense.
So the actual reefs that contain the scheolite are generally relatively narrow.
Yes, they are.
And in the past, the reason the mining has ceased is simply because of the international price or because it's highly fluctuating yields that tend to come from
same
deposits?
No, it's been a fluctuation of market demand. The last 1970s was the last exploration drilling and underground mining occurred up there. It was ACI Minerals, and then the market dropped out after that. And there's actually still a number of people around here who will claim to be the last people mining up there in the 1980s, which was involving bulldozers pushing up the side of the hill right up to some of those very high mountain tops at the back on Mount McIntosh. Most of those roads have all just been washed away now. So that was like a small scale surface mining, I suppose, and generally just finding little outcrops where those veins have come to the outcrop and then just chop off the corners. Being quite steep country as well, there's not the whiteboard. Those hills like this, you can only come back in a small way, and then all of a sudden you've got quite a lot of rock up above you anyway, so you can't actually afford to take out all that rock. So there's only a very small amount that can be taken around from the surface. And so it lends itself quite naturally to the underground mining methods, and they're generally quite horizontal, flat veins or reefs of the rock. And historically, the small tunnels I could stand up in them.
So is this mining, when you think of modern mining, you think of industrial scale, I presume for reasons of economics of scale and for the fact that it was, I guess, safety considerations. Sort of tend to get the impression that unless you're drilling out something very valuable, like gold or something like that, that the economics would sort of tend to militate against it and sort of encourage any production to be sort of open cast type stuff. But you're saying that's not the case?
Historically, the grades of tungsten, which is contained in the scheolite, found at Glenorchy was around an average of 1% within the rock that was mined. Overseas, in an open pit environment, or even underground mines, they're around about 0.3% of tungsten. So the actual grades of the tungsten historically of the scheolite in Glenorchy is actually quite a high quality or high grade by world standards, which certainly helps the economics. Right at the moment, the tungsten price has followed steel, coal, everything else. It's been dropping for the last 2 years. So even now, it's probably just on the marginal cusp of underground mining methods.
but it's not dropping on its way back up again also. So it all comes in, it definitely comes into the play of it. And in just regards to technology, modern mining, yes, there's a need to do it at a scale, probably a whole order of magnitude to previously, but previously everything was done manually. Now you can drill a hole horizontally, probably 10 metres long, whereas previously they were just maybe one, they'd go, it'd take them a week to go 1 metre in the tunnel, but now we can go 20 metres, say, in a week. So you can actually put two tunnels together 10 metres apart and drill between them, and so in the amount of work you're actually producing a lot more rock per tonne, per dollar base. That's where the economies come in. But to put a scale on it out there, it's probably one truck an hour of like a one quarry, a truck that you see driving down the road with gravel in it. Basically, maybe one of those per hour would be a larger scale underground operation. So it's still not a big mine, if you like. And it's limited, naturally limited by the sizes of these reefs, so you can't actually produce a million tonnes a year if you wanted to. You just physically couldn't do it.
So the stuff that's trucked out will be scheelite, so effectively you're going to separate the scheelite from the... But not the metal, obviously, just the scheelite.
That's right. It's correct. So yeah, it's a concentration process, and very similar to... it's the density of scheelite around twice that of the surrounding schist rocks.
And also very heavy.
So it's a similar process to processing for alluvial gold, just using a gravity process. Actually, it's quite interesting if you go up the heritage out there. The old processing plant, which is there, when we started this, we were actually talking to the Battery Society about using that processing plant. So it is the same. The technology hasn't really changed. It's just got better, but it's still doing the heavy stuff to drop to the bottom and the light stuff comes off. And so that processing, and one which I didn't mention last time, which is about the new technology, for instance. Now, X-rays from analysing frozen peas off the production line, they can spot the rocks that have got it in it and actually use that as a way of concentrating it. And so that would be the concentrators generally want salt to go and be processed in the refinery, which involves maybe 2.5.
Yep, so transport costs could be a significant element, because presumably the scheelite has to be shipped to a port and taken overseas.
Yes, no, it's actually numbers. The transport of that concentrate is a relatively small perhaps 500 tons per year of concentrate, which is sort of a lower margin for an economic mine from the work we've done, and a ton of scheelite is around about a 44 gallon drum, so 220 litres. So it's just a truck we can cruise down a week, basically, down to the port. So it's not a big volume there.
Yeah.
So can we just clarify that when you were talking about the dump truck every hour, which that is the gross rock coming out of the mine, is it? And then you concentrate it, and then you have the 44-gallon drum.
That's correct, yeah. So, which is around 1%. So for every tonne of scheelite, there'd be 100 tonnes or 99 tonnes of rock.
So there'll be 100 trucks for one truck load,
yeah? That's right, yeah.
Okay. My maths at that level is quite good.
it's about mining, it's just... that's about it, really. And then there's about three of them in every cubic meter.
Right.
So 500. So then that rock, which doesn't have the scheelite in it, which is non-mineralised rock or tailings or waste, depending on which room we're in, would either go back into the mine underground There's been a lot of it. It's actually a lot of it. The old wines didn't even make it out because if they couldn't see Officer Shillard, then they didn't even bother bringing it out because it was not worth it. It was too much hard work. And or else stacked in a engineering landform landscapes exterior. There's no. It's the same rock basically that's in the hills and the streams now. So no really will see major.
So the message I'm hearing here, because of the nature of the deposit, that does occur on masses, vein type deposits, you're not getting massive scale mining, but that it does seem to be scattered over a very wide area according to the map. I mean, the Quartz Evans might have had a big aerial photo which showed a whole lot of drive sites scattered over a very large area of land. So how much, if you talk about truckloads, how much roading would be constructed?
Roads to the entrances of the mines.
I know there's a road goes up Mount Judah, but I don't know whether you need a lot of side roads that have to be constructed off that.
Yeah, there's roads and tracks all over the area actually, which have been bulldozed, and a lot of them have been washed away. How do I describe road? The Jones Road, which does go up Judy, does swing all the way around. Actually, it goes right up the top of the mountain and back around as well. So, not a lot more roading probably than what's actually there currently. It's just that you need to be developed so that it actually is suitable and safe. It's borderline, if it's a really rich mine, to helicopter the rock out.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Primarily just because there's now a helicopter company based in Glenorchy, which we did look at it for one of the mines just to get a bulk sample, but it's quite expensive.
Okay, and I think that's very helpful background.
So, yes, so they're naturally limited to small scale mining, that in these veins are not close together generally. There's a series of six or seven reefs that historically they think they've found, and they may be separated by 50 metres vertically apart, so they're too far apart really to be part of the same mine. There's a lot of rock in between, it's not worth any money there. And the money's point about the modern mine management, mining methods which allow existing heritage and environmental values to be protected and even enhanced. My expectation all the way since even before we get looking at heritage landscape is that we will be establishing visitor. It goes hand in hand with mining and expects to actually be a part of those things. And so mining activities can contribute to heritage by improving the amenity value and up the particular safety of existing heritage sites, to provide safe access for visitors to the underground workings, and provide such things as a visitor centre to educate and inform about the heritage values of the Glenorchy landscape. To enable future generations to benefit from mineral resource assets and the heritage values from the Glenorchy landscape, the district plan does need to recognise the importance of future mining within the GHL, and that this future mining is a part of the natural long-term cycle involved in mining projects. That's an important thing which we laboured on last time, is that the cycles of mining and the periods of years, 10s or 20s or 30s or 40s, 50 years between, and worldwide at the moment there's a number of tonnage mines actually coming back online after being about 50 years out of action.
So you'd expect a continuing pattern of probably wax and wane as has happened over the last 150 years?
Yes, it's very common. I mean, and apart from the cycles that have been all here, typically been the wars, First World War, Second World War, Vietnam War had a little bit of production, the Hemerdon mine in the UK has just reopened. It's a tungsten and tin mine. It's the first metal mine operating in the UK in 50 years, I think. And very, very similar, same time frames to the Glenorchy areas around here. And they then just continue the exploration process, drilling, remodeling, new little technology in mind is actually the computers that drive it, the ability to design and plan in a way that's actually very much more productive, which leads to the safety and environmental benefits. They're now mining, and it is a large open pit mine that they're mining there, but their lead rates, for instance, I think 0.02% of tons consuming 10, almost 50 times less than a year.
But I guess the reason for that is it's much closer to its ultimate user, yes. Whereas we're a long way from the ultimate user, which has to be compensated for by higher yields per tonne.
Yeah, well, it's actually the shipping cost of that concentrate is, sale price of the concentrate is perhaps $15,000 to $25,000 a tonne over the last 10 years. So the shipping cost from here to Europe is maybe about $300 per tonne. So it's that the actual shipping of the concentrate is not such a limiting factor. It's more... I suppose it's a bit more similar to like the Macraes gold mine where there's a lot of low grade but it's a big area that you can just go in and then if they're mining 6 million tonnes a year of it and the market ultimately there is majority that goes to Austria actually I think or the European market where people realise that you need to have a sovereign supply and guaranteed supply of quite important things, yeah. I might just then go to my conclusion on this. While I'm running through in 8.7, my picture of the Hobbit entrance to the film, it's actually quite a serious concept. I mean, pretty much you've got a hole in the ground that you can do anything you want with to make it work. And the difference is that up in Massamatta with this Hobbit, when you open the door, there's actually nothing behind it. You can't actually go on and build shit into there. I think we have a real opportunity to bring the hobbits to life.
Given the fate of the main tunnel, it might actually do very close to hobbits.
I was thinking more that tourists will actually come and pay us to do the mine.
Serious.
The ultimate optimist.
Yeah. Well, actually, the previous partners I had in this one was the Austrian tungsten mining company. So they no longer are. I know in times of poor economics back in the 80s, 90s, their mine in Austria, they actually did run it as a total tourist operation for about 2.5-3 years while the oil price was right down, which enabled them to keep their employees employed and actually quite a successful little tourist mine. So if I'll just, if there's no questions on the way through, I'm going to ask them anyway. So in the conclusions here, since the 1800s, mining has contributed significantly to the communities of Queensland Lakes District. And the old mining sites do now provide the district with a wealth of heritage and the North Inchula deposits do have the potential to contain significant amounts of tungsten, having spent the last 2 days traveling heritage sites around Otago, including down to Dunedin, and I realised that I think the Norky could become the end of the Otago Gold Trail, really, the only feature at the moment. And modern day mining can work hand in hand with heritage to protect and preserve it, as well as enabling the current use and development of the probably most people that visit the area up there are interested in the mining history. Modern day mining methods and attitudes have also come a long way. I think attitudes is an important change that's definitely happened. And mining will not have a large negative impact on the heritage. The heritage protection and enhancement is considered as part of the mine planning process. So we do think about it when planning the mine. People are having to make sure that we don't go anywhere that we shouldn't. And modern mining methods are also able to minimise the adverse effects by being very specific and targeted to where we want them to actually occur. NZDM, we do have objectives that are broader than just extracting minerals from within GHL. NZTM generally, for myself personally, also we're going to want to protect and enhance the ability for people to experience and understand the mining heritage within the GHL, but also more generally, because mining, most people are ignorant of what mining involves, and personally I'd like to see that turned around. And to enable future generations to benefit from the mineral resource assets that are contained within the district. The district plan does need to recognise the importance of mining to the district and accommodate those long-term cycles that are involved. Tons of involved. It's 2001 is when it actually began this project up there, so it does take a long time to keep going through. So because of that, I do consider the PVP should take guidance from examples elsewhere, both in New Zealand and overseas, and provide for the future mining within the Milwaukee heritage landscape in a way that does allow modern mining and also enhances the existing heritage values within that area.
Turning a bit to the landscape effects and trying to paint a picture of here that what you've just been discussing. Typically, on the mountain face or on wherever the mine site is, what would one expect to see in the form of, say, buildings and vehicles at any one time? On see a truck park there and a little tin shed, or what would you think would be there?
Majority will be underground. One building above the surface of the ground, which is basically the floor. It can go from nothing, actually, to everything. What I think, obviously, because of the area, it has to be really minimal and fitting. Any building on the surface, I still see it being. I see it actually with it's just rock on the outside of the building made to look like a part of it. There'd be a building. Everything basically sits inside the mine. A workshop that you need for workshop. For machinery, which again is just fit in aesthetically. The reason it's difficult is because before we've drilled the holes and actually what we've got to work with, if you've got lots of money, then you can do lots of things. But small machinery, it's quite small, four-wheel drive, Hilux size vehicles above the ground, except for a truck. If it's large enough, maybe it's a conveyor belt that's actually used to carry the rock around the hill instead of actually vehicles, just at some more cost.
I think that'd be a movable kind of thing, I assume.
You'd establish it. Unless it's going to. Unless it contributes to the heritage. Well, there's some very nice black elm thing pipe that contributes to the heritage up there at the moment, which is like. Doctors are quite keen on that since the early 80s. We can provide as much of that as needed. This one will be picking. No, I don't expect to take it away. It's quite nice. But it's hard to describe much that doesn't happen. I looked in quite detail on another site, permits, not on the GHL area, and all we have there will be very similar scale. Is the only above-ground building really is one for an office first aid. People to have a workshop, which is really probably the size of this room, but higher roof. And so by dovetailing in with you choose your spot on the landscape and make sure that it actually is not visually significant. I did take a photograph in Dunedin just the other day, but I didn't bring it with me, of a, you might know, up Signal Hill. Just as you come down on the left, it is just wall building, which is an old barn, but it steps down in levels, so it's 3 metre height and then it drops another 3 metres, which is a sort of by a process of what happened, which is gravity is moving it downwards. But here from the outside, it's just looks like a good old heritage building, which that's what I see actually doing. It's difficult up there because actual road access is. There's no legal road access up there anymore. The Mount Jet Road is privately owned now. So
Yeah, I was going to ask that. The land is all in Dock Estate now, is it? The one
that no, the Glenroy Hedge landscape actually covers Dock and also Primary Yards land.
Is it Waiuna Station?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Another thing I want to answer, maybe much for Marie as anybody to answer, because it's a bit of creative mining 101 for a bomb. But I just want to understand the interface with the Mining Act, because it's a separate code that you've got mining licences. What does that actually override or displace any RMA requirements?
So the Operative Act is the Crown Minerals Act?
Yep.
Yep, which superseded the Mining Act.
Yep.
So your question is about the Crown Minerals Act?
How does that interface with the RMA?
It's completely separate.
Yep.
Yep, so under the Crown Minerals Act, which is about the Crown getting royalties for Crown-owned minerals, a miner needs a permit for the various stages of mining, prospecting, exploration and mining. You need different permits for those different stages of the process. And the permits themselves, and Gary can talk in more detail about what they look like, but they are just about the size of the mineral resource, the program that the permit holder's got to win it, because Crown Minerals want to make sure that all of the permit holders are actually advancing their permits,
yeah,
so that they'll eventually get the minerals so that they can get their royalties. It's Marie 101, you'll probably tell me I got that wrong. But that's their job, is to make sure people are moving forwards with their permits, because if they're not, there's a process to get tendered or give it to someone else who will win the minerals for the ground.
More about the ownership of the
mineral. It's all about the ownership of the mineral.
So it doesn't help you in terms of putting up buildings and digging holes and things like that if they are caught by a district plan?
No, that's right. But then when the mineral is on Crown-owned land, which is generally Dock or Lynns, then you also, as well as having your minerals, your mining permit, you need an access arrangement, which is a legal construct under the Crown Minerals Act. And that does cover similar but different environmental factors as the Resource Management Act. So it's a subject to a different test still. It's not a replacement for the sustainable management purpose, and no one ever pretends it is. The test is measured against the piece of legislation that the land is managed under and a statutory purpose that the land is managed for. So say it's in a piece of conservation land, there'll be most likely a conservation management plan or some sort of document that the access arrangement gets assessed against, and DOC will often impose very similar requirements for resource consent on the miner, but the miner still, always in my experience, has to go still through the same as different process under the Resource Management Act, and DOC is then often a submitter on resource consent. So it's a funny old system, and there is duplication, and it is difficult for miners to manage their way through that efficiently, and then they'll also need their historic places authorities as well, presumably. So all of those things do duplicate. No one has managed to get rid of that duplication yet. It's just a fact of being a miner under this regime.
Now the related question to that is, and it's touched on Mr. Vivian Zeppelin's office, he's not here, is what I've been trying to focus my mind on is what the heritage provisions of the plan do that go over and beyond those of an ONL and the rural rules, which you've obviously submitted on separately. And my correct understanding is that the primary things that goes over and beyond is if you interfere with a site that's been used as a mine in the past because of its heritage values, or its potential disturbance of the archaeology in or around a mine site. Is that the over and above provisions that we're dealing with here?
Well, one of the key provisions that we're seeking be deleted from the heritage chapter is the requirement that any development in the heritage landscape area that triggers a consent. And that's marked up in Mr. Vivian's evidence. And I think that was accepted, that change, by the council officer.
Yep.
As being too general and broad, it's not really helpful. So instead, the suggestion is that the specific list of activities in the heritage landscape area require consent, and those are sort of supported in the final bit of Mr. Vivian's evidence. Mm. So that's what's over and above the general rural chapter, and then we've also sought a refinement to the description of the heritage landscape areas, what is the lead features?
Yeah,
so that it's again more specific in terms of what aspect of the heritage landscape's features that make it up that are then regulated under the chapter. Mm.
Rather than anything that was within the large defined area of the landscape.
Yeah.
So if you use an existing drive, like there's a photograph one here, paragraph 8.2, it's quite a good picture of the state mine within the GHL, you'd accept you'd need, even under reduced regulation, you'd still need some kind of consent for that.
Yes. Or,
Okay.
Well, you'd need consent anyway, because mining is discretionary. But as part of that assessment for that discretionary mining activity, you add in the heritage emphasis.
Of a particular, I understand that. That's good. Thanks very much.
Cool. I'm having difficulty understanding, given that virtually nothing is permitted in the rural zone, why you're trying to get rid of any requirement for consent in the heritage area, given you need a consent anyway.
You do need a consent anyway.
So what difference does it make if there is also a provision in another chapter that also requires it? Real difference.
I might give a civilian to give some thought to that question. Somebody can answer it in a specific, helpful way.
Yes, I mean, it's not unusual. For instance, in a regional situation, to have 7 or 8 different consents on the same application, but in a district plan, generally the fact that you require consents under more than one part of the plan still leads you to just get one consent, doesn't it?
Yes.
So that's not complicating things like it may in a regional circumstance.
No, we'll give
that some thought. Yeah, that was the base of my question here. I'm not sort of saying regulations could be a soul or anything like that. I'm just trying to make sure I'm clear in my head. I'm almost thinking, well, is this actually going to get you anywhere? That was almost that question, I suppose, one way of putting it. As long as that's clear, well, Mr. Vivian can clarify that for us.
Yep,
that would be good.
We'll
be able to clarify that. Now that it's lunchtime.
Okay.
I'm good. Until 2 o'clock tonight, and we'll still have further questions, Mr. Gray, I suspect.
Great, I'll make sure he comes back.
We sit down until 10:03, so we've
got 10 minutes. Yes, that's sufficient time. Good, thank you.